Okay, let me set for you where we are at, as we are still in the midst of the Reformed Church, or we call it the Church of the Reformation. And we are looking, strangely enough, at a very short window of time. In reality, this series on the Reformation Church has really only taken us from about the beginning of the 16th century into the middle of the 16th century. Only a period of about 50 years of time. A very small time, considering that where we are is 16 centuries from the beginning of the church. So we're talking about a tiny, tiny window, 1/32nd, if you will, of that period of time in the entirety of the church, that the Lord did unimaginable things in this time frame. Now, in the course of this, of course, as we started this period, we know of we're reminded again that the Western medieval church, what we would call the Catholic Church today, was deeply corrupt ecclesiastically and theologically. Its structure was corrupt. Its leadership was corrupt. Its understanding of the things of Christ was corrupt. And there were many who recognized that the church had moved dramatically away from its roots in what Paul and the other apostles had established in the New Testament. So into this world, of course, is born Martin Luther, who has his theological epiphany, and then his ideas, springing from justification by faith alone, spread out into Europe. It doesn't take long for these ideas to spread out quickly. Almost identically with him, in fact, within just a few months, another man is born by the name of Ulrich Zwingli, who comes to similar realizations regarding the issues of faith, the issues of justification by faith. Now, he comes in a different path. He doesn't come through the experiential route that Luther comes through. He comes more through the studious and intellectual route. But nonetheless, he arrives at the same conclusion at virtually the same time. Two men that did not meet and did not discuss these things, but somehow came to the same conclusions at virtually the same time. Arising alongside of these two great magisterial reformers then were a number of men which we called the radical reformers. Last week we talked about the Anabaptist movement, the belief amongst many that the reforms of Luther and Zwingli had not gone far enough. Luther and Zwingli were content to simply attempt to reform the existing church. The Anabaptists believed that something new needed to be born, a church that was separated from the magisterium and was entirely distinct and autonomous from that magisterium. And they believed, therefore, that the Reformation needed to go very much farther. So, in the first half of the 16th century, we see this explosion of Reformation throughout Germany and Switzerland, which then swept through the rest of the continent, including France. And it is into this time frame that we now discuss the third of the great magisterial reformers behind Luther and Zwingli, and that, of course, is a man by the name of John Calvin. It's into this world that John Calvin is born, and John Calvin would be led by the Lord into becoming, in my opinion, the most significant theologian of the era. In fact, one could make a very convincing argument that John Calvin is probably the greatest theologian that ever lived, second only to the Apostle Paul himself, who I have often argued is the greatest interpreter of Jesus that ever lived. Inspired by God, writing establishing and writing to the church in his day, did more to interpret and advance the cause of Christ than anyone else, but I think John Calvin is pretty close behind him. A close third would be, of course, Augustine, writing behind him. But Augustine was a man of a different age, a much earlier age, and not as broad of a theological perspective was available to Augustine at the time. And so it is into a very different world that John Calvin comes, and I think that's what makes him such a tremendous theologian. And one who would come to tie together all of the various Protestant doctrines into a cohesive whole. It's going to be Calvin who's going to take all of the disparate ideas of the Reformation and bring them together in a systematic way. and even extend beyond Luther and Zwingli in a tremendous way. So, John Calvin is often considered to be a second-generation reformer. You will often see commentators and scholars speak of him in that sense. And what they mean by that is that he's so much younger than Luther and Zwingli that he is into another generation, if you will. Okay, that he's behind them. But in reality, Luther was a contemporary of both men. He was younger, but he was a contemporary. He lived at the same time. He lived in the first half of the 16th century, in that same 50-year window. The bulk of his life was contained in that window. So I don't see him as a second-generation reformer at all. I prefer to see him as a first-generation reformer who is a part of the main magisterial reformers of the church in the days of Luther and Zwingli, in that window of time that God did this amazing providential work to bring about a reformation, a reformed church, and I put him squarely in that. I don't think you get to a second generation until you move later, and we'll talk about that in future weeks. Now, to talk about Calvin, we need to discuss at least two, if not three, things about him. We certainly need to talk about the man. We certainly need to uncover his biography. But we also need to, in order to be fair, we need to also discuss his theology. And I think, as well, we need to discuss his importance to the Reformation. As I've implied, Luther and Zwingli took the Reformation to a certain extent and perspective, but it is Calvin who is, in many ways, going to extend that Reformation beyond what Luther and Zwingli could have imagined. In fact, I think that Calvin, in many ways, although not an Anabaptist, would certainly appeal to the Anabaptists and would later appeal to future movements like the Anabaptists because of his cohesiveness and because of the extent of his theology. And so, in many ways, while Calvin may have been the father of the Reformation, Luther may have been the father of the Reformation, Calvin was its teacher. Calvin was its theologian. So that's how I would view him. So we're going to look at him first biographically. We're going to do that tonight. And then, Lord willing, we're going to come back next week and talk about his theology. And then we'll get into issues of his importance to us even now. So let's talk about the biography of Calvin. And we'll start with his early life and career. John Calvin was born in the small village of Noyon, France, July the 10th, 1509. Yes, something good can come out of France. My name is Gervais, as you know. That is a French derivation, of French derivation. My ancestors are immigrants that came from France to Canada, settled in the Montreal area, and then some of them settled in the north, and others moved to Louisiana. There are a lot of Gervais in Minnesota and in Louisiana. But, hey, the best come from France, see? Now, I mean, not much comes good out of France anymore, so I kind of hide that, but that's why we changed our name from Gervais to Jarvis. See it? Luther was 26 years old when Calvin was born, which is part of the reason why many think of him as a second-generation reformer. He's not in the first 26 years. In fact, Luther was already lecturing in Wittenberg at the time that Calvin was born. Zwingli, who was less than 2 months younger than Luther, you remember, had already achieved his master's degree and was serving as a priest in Galruz. Calvin was only 8 years old when Luther tacked his 95 theses to the chapel door in 1517, being born in 1509. Now, in a strange sort of way, Calvin and Luther had a similar parental reality. His father, Calvin's father, was a part of the rising middle class, as was Luther's, and he served as a secretary to the bishop of the local cathedral, the local Catholic church. So he held a position of some influence in this village, and so like Luther, Calvin benefited from this middle class lifestyle. such that his father was able to procure for him a good liberal arts education at the time. He used his business acumen and his political connections, even his ecclesiastical connections, to procure a good education for young John. So young Calvin studied first in Paris. He went to Paris and was introduced there to the great humanist thinkers that were there in Paris at the time, and even to a number of conservative voices who were reacting against humanism in the day that were there in the schools in Paris. He was sent to study theology. It is likely that his father intended for him to become a priest, like so many others would become who went to theology school. While he was there, he was involved in various debates between the humanists and the traditionalists that were there in the schools, debating the realities of these two things. And he was introduced in those days to the teachings of Wycliffe and Huss and Luther. You remember that Wycliffe and Huss were the two early reformers, about 100 years before Luther, who had first started the idea of reformation of the church, and then it was Luther who then picked up on some of those teachings later and extended them. So he was introduced to these writers, and even in 1528, at the age of 19, he received a Master of Arts degree himself. But Calvin was a staunch Catholic while he was in Paris. He later wrote this, quote, "I was stubbornly tied to the superstitions of the papacy," unquote. He admits that while he was there in Paris listening to the preaching and teaching of the humanists and the traditionalists there, and even being introduced to Wycliffe and Huss and even Luther, he still stubbornly clung to his heritage. His father, working for the bishop in the village where he came from, was significant to him. It caused him to continue to hold fast to the Catholic doctrines. These early introductions to Reformed thinking probably influenced the direction of his future, but at this point, there is no indication, it does not appear at all, that they substantially made any impact upon his thinking. That while he was in these young years in Paris learning theology and earning his master's degree, which, by the way, a master's degree then would be equivalent to a high school degree today, he was studying to learn theology, to go off into whatever profession he was eventually going to take on, but it doesn't appear that these teachings had any real effect upon him. In the meantime, his father, back in Lyon, had a falling out with the bishop. We're not exactly sure what it was that they fought about. Commentators are confused about what the possibility might have been. But in any case, this falling out with the bishop caused Calvin's father to lose his influence in the city and his financial support from the church. So in response, his father instructed young John to end his study of theology and study instead or pursue instead a career in law, to become a lawyer. Now, in Paris, you could not study civil law. The only law that you could study in Paris was ecclesiastical law, meaning the law of the church. So John had to leave Paris in order to study theology. To study law. This was in 1527. So he went to Orleans and Bourges under two famous jurists of the time. Ironically, as I was writing this morning, I was watching last night a movie, an old movie. Some of you may remember it, called The Paper Chase. Any of you remember? This was John Houseman's debut as an actor, where he plays a law professor in Harvard Law School, and it's about a student that is in his class dating his daughter, unbeknownst to him, and it's an interesting intrigue and so forth. And I just couldn't help but think of that as I was thinking about Calvin sitting under these two great jurists of the day who knew the law. Now, one of them was a man by the name of Pierre de L'Estoile. I have no idea how to pronounce that. It's French, and I don't speak French, so it's Pierre something or another. Pierre followed the traditional method for the study and interpretation of the law. In other words, he took the perspective that you read the law, you understand what it says, you apply that law in a sense in which you recognize how it was written, why it was written, who wrote it, and to what it's written for. Okay? The other man was a man by the name of Andrea Alsati, Alsati. He was a humanist. Okay, so he came from the other camp, and he had a reputation for being somewhat pompous in his approach. His approach to the law was to think about the law not so much in terms of the jot and tittle of what the law says, but rather how the law applies and what it means to us, what we can do with it, how we can deal with it. Okay, it's a very real difference of perspective. If you haven't spent any time understanding that, that's fine. But humanism, if you remember, is the study or the belief that the primary subject of study is us, humans. Okay, humanism puts humanity at the center in the sense that you study man as the center of all things. Humanism, you remember, was significantly a part of the Renaissance. It was a part of the what caused the Renaissance to flow out. Okay. So you have this humanist here who is looking at law, and he's looking at it in terms of its value to humanity rather than to the actual nuts and bolts of it. Well, these two men got into some sort of controversy in the law school while Calvin was there. And as he was listening to both sides of the controversy, Calvin sided with the traditionalist. Okay? Now I want you to notice that, because I think that this is an early influence upon Calvin. He took the side of the view of this subject, whatever it was, on the side of the guy who's more inclined to look at it from the nuts and bolts perspective of what does it say, what does it mean, rather than how do I feel about it on the other side. Okay? And you will notice that that's going to have, I think, an impact upon how Calvin is going to go about his work of being a systematic thinker when it comes to systematic theology. He's going to be systematic in his approach to theology rather than just sort of, well, let's just talk about how this makes us feel sort of thing. Okay? So I'll let you hold that thought, because when we come back to our discussion of theology, Calvin's theology next week, that'll be important. It'll also be important in a minute for something else. Calvin's father died in 1531 while he was in Paris. And so with the death of his father, while he was at Bourget, with the death of his father, Calvin decided he didn't want to be a lawyer after all. He didn't want to pursue a career in the law, and so he decided to return to Paris to pick up his study in theology and in philosophy and literature. And while he was there, he joined up again with a group of humanist friends, some who were evangelical-minded, some who were familiar with the Reformation teachings now spreading out through Central Europe. The Reformation had come to France. And there were men, evangelical-thinking humanists, there in Paris, who were sympathetic to the teachings of Luther and others, and the thoughts of these men were beginning to come out. Sometime between August of 1533 and May of 1534, sometime between August of 1533 and May of 1534, Calvin apparently experienced some sort of evangelical conversion. At some point, he came to an understanding of the gospel and repudiated his Catholicism. Now, you'll notice I say apparently, because we don't really know when and how this occurred in Calvin's life. It appears that it occurred while he was studying law in Paris. In other words, between that window of August of 1533 and May of 1534, while he was in Paris, was somewhere during that period of time. But we're not really sure exactly why or when. But it appears that he discovered somewhere along the way. Now, let me stop and say this again. It appears that this occurred while he was studying law in Paris in obedience to his father who was still alive. Okay? And that he discovered somewhere that God had a different plan for his life. He writes almost nothing about his own conversion. That's our problem. We don't have much. Luther wrote gobs about his life and his experience, right? He wrote about his childhood. He wrote about his conversion. He wrote about so many things. We can analyze Luther's life to the second. But Calvin's, we're not really sure. We do know that he comes to faith. I mean, he becomes one of the strongest and leading candidates of Reformed theology in Europe. But we're not really sure where. He writes this in a book called The Preface to the Commentary on Psalms. He writes, quote, "Since I was too obstinately devoted to the superstitions of popery to be easily extricated from so profound an abyss of mire, God, by a sudden conversion, subdued and brought my mind to a teachable frame, which was more hardened in such matters than might have been expected from one at my early period of life. Having thus received some taste and knowledge of true godliness, I was immediately inflamed with so intense a desire to make progress therein that, although I did not altogether leave off other studies, I yet pursued them with less ardor." Unquote. Now, that's an emotional experience, isn't it? No, it's not. It's a man saying, you know, I was so much a Catholic that there was no way out of it. But God somehow brought my mind to an understanding which was hardened against these things. But nonetheless, he brought me to understand these things. So, having some taste of godliness, I began to pursue it intellectually. That's his conversion story. I mean, bring Calvin in and put him up here on some Sunday morning to give his testimony, everybody out there would be asleep halfway through it. There's no excitement in it. But there doesn't have to be. Okay, that's a modern kind of thing anyways, by the way, the whole emotional experience conversion story. So in other words, Calvin's conversion was clearly not the same as Luther's, right? Luther's came about as the result of a tortured life, of a man who struggled to understand his place of sin against a holy God, and he wrestled with his own reality, even at some point becoming even quasi-suicidal in this. Calvin is sitting there one day and somehow goes, oh yeah, you're probably right. Maybe I should pursue this gospel thing. And does. I mean, they couldn't be more different in their approach. In their conversion. Calvin's conversion was born out of a deep intellectual understanding of the realities of the gospel over against the corruption of Rome. But it was not overtly emotional in its track. Now, this should give you an idea, then, of the kind of man that Luther was, that Calvin was. Right? It should give you an idea of the kind of man he was. What kind of a man was he? He was an intellectual giant. A man of unparalleled thinking power. His whole life was in his head. He was a thinker. He was an intellectual. He was a strong man of thinking. He understood and pursued the world through the basis of his ability to think it through and understand it. And that is what bears itself out, it does it not, why he is such a great thinker when it comes to theology. When you read his works of theology, you see the depth of his theology. On my shelf, I have as a gift from someone in the church a set of Calvin's commentaries on the Bible. It's 26 volumes wide to cover the Bible. And it doesn't even have a commentary on Revelation because Calvin refused to write one. It's a huge work. He was an amazing thinker. But he was converted. He did come to faith in Christ. He did come to understand that the Catholic Church was corrupt. He called it a popish superstitions, right? He came to understand that the Church was corrupt. He came to understand the true gospel, the Pauline, Augustinian gospel. He came to understand these things, and he began a pursuit of understanding that. So in 1534, he returned to the village of Noyon, that is after his father had died, and gave up the ecclesiastical posts his father had secured for him. His father had intended, as I said earlier, for him to become a priest, and he had used his influence as his father to secure for him certain ecclesiastical posts there in the village, but he came back and he repudiated those posts. Now, again, it is unknown when Calvin came back to Noyon if, in fact, he had been converted. And leaving those posts was his first break with the Catholic Church. We don't know that. It could be that he simply came back and decided, look, I don't want to be a priest. He was still a Catholic at the time, still hadn't had a conversion, came back and simply said, I don't want to be a priest. I want to study literature and theology and that sort of thing for the rest of my life. Could be. Or it could be that he had come to faith in Christ, and now he goes back home and says, I certainly don't want to be a Catholic priest. I'm going to give up these ecclesiastical posts. There's no way to know, because we don't really know when this conversion takes place. In October of 1534, Emperor Francis I, you remember him? Remember, Francis I was the other emperor who was ruling over Europe in the days of the Holy Roman Empire, one of the two emperors who were vying for the position of the empire when the emperor of Germany had died. And you remember it was Charles I who had become the emperor instead of Francis I. So Francis I is still the emperor over France at this time. Francis I, in 1534, changes his policy of tolerance towards Protestants to a policy of persecution of them. Now, 1534 is 17 years after Luther tacks his thesis to the door of the Chapel of Wittenberg. Okay, 17 years of time have passed since the Reformation began. So it is widespread. There is a Protestant movement now, not just a Lutheran movement, a Protestant movement throughout Europe. And Francis I in France, now that the Reformation has come to France, and it has been tolerated for a while, but now Francis I decides to change his policy. Now he begins to persecute the Protestants as a Catholic himself. So in January of 1535, Calvin left France and went into exile in the city of Basel in Switzerland. Basel was a Protestant city which had accepted Protestantism and embraced it, in fact. And so Calvin fled to that place. He intended to live out the rest of his life there, studying literature, to settle down in a calm environment where he could study scripture and write about the faith. Here's what he writes about that time. Quote, being of a disposition somewhat unpolished and bashful, which led me always to love the shade and retirement, I then began to seek some secluded corner where I might be withdrawn from the public view. In short, while my one great object was to live in seclusion without being known, God led me about through different turnings and changes that He never permitted me to rest in any place until, in spite of my natural disposition, He brought me forth to public notice. In other words, Calvin says, I wanted to just go find a tree somewhere and sit under it and write books and read theology and write my little pamphlets and so forth and just be left alone. I didn't want to be in the public eye. But God had a different plan. His main project was to write a short summary of the Christian faith from a Protestant perspective. His idea was to summarize the whole of theology from beginning to end, from the perspective of a Protestant rather than the perspective of a Catholic. At this particular point in time, Protestant thinking, the writings and arguments and discussions and lectures and sermons that were being produced at this time from amongst Protestant thinkers was primarily with polemics. Polemics, as you remember, is to make an argument against someone else's position that you think is wrong. Okay? So polemics was to make arguments, to debate the veracity of somebody else's position, especially if you believe their position was wrong. So most of the Protestant writings at the time were simply polemics against what they held to be wrong within the Catholic Church. Some examples. Most of the writings at this time had to do with the structure of the church and how that structure was wrong. The clerical realities of celibacy were wrong. The Catholic Church had embraced clerical celibacy. The Protestants said, no, that's wrong. We shouldn't do that. When it comes to the sacraments, particularly the sacrament of the Lord's Supper, baptism not so much debated, but the Lord's Supper being highly debated. Remember the debate between Zwingli and Luther was over communion and how it was to be perceived. Okay, a polemic between the two of them. So a lot of the thinking going on at this time, in the days of Calvin, which would be late in this 50-year, this period of time, was only against what the Catholic Church was teaching. Calvin came along and said, no, we can do better than that. We need to produce a more robust theology. We need to be able to understand, articulate and understand the totality of what God has revealed to us about Himself from beginning to end. We'll start with the doctrine of God, the doctrine of Scripture, the doctrine of creation, the doctrine of man. We'll talk about the doctrine of sin, the doctrine of salvation, the doctrine of the church, the doctrine of end times, and so on, from beginning to end. You remember what took me about 3 years to do here on Wednesday nights called a theology class. Remember, that's the totality of it. That's what Calvin believed that he could produce. So Calvin desired to pen a treatise on the robust view of theology flowing out of the ramifications of justification by faith. If you start with justification by faith, what ramifications does that have on your view of God? On your view of Christ? On your view of the Spirit, on your view of the world, on your view of angels, on your view of man, and so on and so on and so on. Okay, so he began to think that justification by faith doesn't just affect the sacraments, it affects everything. And so he wanted to write a treatise on a robust view of theology. So he began his magnum opus, probably the book he's most famous for, The Institutes of the Christian Religion. He began to write this sometime around 1435. The first version of it was a short work, short, 500 pages, short, designed to be printed so that it could fit in a standard shirt pocket and could be read by the average person. Originally published in Latin, French versions followed shortly thereafter when he wrote them. He continued to revise this work for the rest of his life. He published new versions of it in 1539, 1543, 1550, and 1559. First one in Latin, and then about a year later, another in French. Now, we'll come back to a discussion of the Institutes in our next lesson, Lord willing, because in reality, the Institutes are his theology. Okay, so if we're going to talk about his theology, we need to talk about the Institutes. So his early life is to grow up as a Catholic, go to school as a Catholic, somewhere along the way have some sort of evangelical conversion, and then set about to go find a quiet, solitary place to write on theology. Calvin had no intention of becoming a leader in the Reformation. No intention whatsoever of becoming a leader in the Reformation. Difficulties, however, in Basel forced him to consider a new location from where he was at. So he made a short visit to Ferrara, and then he went back to France for a brief visit, but eventually decided that he would settle in Strasbourg. Strasbourg, as you know, is on the western side of France, near Switzerland, and so he decided that was going to be the place where he was going to spend the rest of his life. Protestantism had been victorious in the city of Strasbourg, and the environment was ripe for his theological and literary studies. He felt like this would be a perfect place where he would not have to defend himself against Catholic incursions, and so he would be able to go there and read and write and live out an ordinary life. But the route to Strasbourg was closed by military operations, and Calvin had to make a detour through the city of Geneva. My friends, if that isn't the providence of God, I don't know what is. Okay? A few months before he had arrived in Geneva, the city had been turned to Protestantism under the leadership of a missionary who had come from the city of Bern by the name of William Farrell. That's an important name because it's important in Calvin's life. The city government of the city of Geneva had, upon the convincing of the missionary, abolished the Catholic Mass. There was a small nucleus of educated laity in the city, and a number of well-positioned bourgeoisie, meaning the middle class, who believed that it was necessary for Geneva to become a Protestant city. Some of them were afraid of what the effect might be when the Catholics were booted out of town, naturally. We saw that kind of thing, you remember, in previous discussions, particularly in our discussion later in Luther's life when you started to see sides having to be taken, particularly in Switzerland in Zwingli's day. They were worried about that, but they eventually abolished the Catholic Mass and turned the city into a Protestant haven. Now, Calvin, as he arrived, only intended to stay in the city for a single day. He wanted to stay there one day and continue on his journey to Strasbourg. But William Farrell was informed that the author of the Institutes was in town. A famous man had arrived. And Farrell arranged for an interview with Calvin. Calvin, by the way, records much of the interview that he has with Mr. Farrell. Farrell tried to convince Calvin that he was desperately needed in the city. And Calvin recognized that Farrell had a great missionary zeal for the gospel. He says, Calvin does, very clearly, that Farrell very much loved the Lord, very much wanted to see the church prosper and flourish in the city of Geneva. But it needed leadership, and it needed a strong leader like Calvin. But Calvin refused to listen to his appeals. He didn't want to get involved. He wanted to go, you know, live under a tree somewhere and read his books and write his pamphlets. And he didn't want to get involved, especially in the situation in the city, which was a little bit confused. It hadn't quite reached all the way to perfection in terms of Protestants. And he didn't want to get involved. So he resisted Mr. Farrell. But Mr. Farrell pulled out a weapon. And the weapon was a threat. And he said this to Calvin, which Calvin records, quote, "May God condemn your repose and the calm you seek for study, if before such a great need you withdraw and refuse your succor and help." Unquote. He turns to Calvin and he says, "All right, you can go live under a tree, but my prayer is going to be that God's going to make that a horrible time for you." And Calvin wrote later, he said, "These words shocked and broke me, and I desisted from the journey." He made the choice to stay in the city and became what is commonly referred to as the reformer of Geneva. He entered and began his ministry work there in Geneva in 1536. It didn't take long for Calvin to become the central figure of the city, of course, and the religious life of the city, even though he had originally only intended to help Farrell with his leadership. In other words, to work as a partner with Farrell in the city to lead. But it became obvious that the roles would eventually switch, where Farrell would become the assistant to Calvin, and Calvin would be the primary leader in that place. The two pastors began to teach that the Reformation principles that had been established needed to be taken seriously. Again, think about Calvin's mind. Calvin is thinking about the effect of the gospel not just upon the emotions of a man, but upon the life of a man. And Calvin and Farrell believed that if the Reformation was going to truly take hold in the city, then the people living in the city were going to live those Reformation principles. Specifically, the two men insisted, and Calvin in particular, that the principles of Reformation demanded that an unrepentant sinner needed to be excommunicated from the church. If a man was truly justified by faith, but his life did not reflect that faith in continuing sin, then it stood as reasonable that such a man should not be considered a part of the church. In other words, he presented an ecclesiastical ordinance that would subject the citizens of the city to a degree of moral control. Being a Christian demanded teaching and conformity to such morality, he taught. But the influential middle class of the city, who originally supported the break with Rome, considered this going too far. The local government was controlled by these men, and they refused to allow this form of excommunication to be accomplished by the church. They believed that the state was the only one that was allowed to make such judgments, and so they resisted Calvin's ecumenical ordinance. They claimed it was an unwarranted rigorism and a usurpation of government authority. And so Calvin was banned from the city in April 1538. William Farrell was allowed to remain behind, but he said, if Calvin's gone, so am I. And so he left with him. Calvin returned to Strasbourg, or better, went to Strasbourg, really returned. He went to Strasbourg, but he wondered if, in fact, he had missed God's call while he was there. In Strasbourg, he met a man by the name of Martin Bucer, the leader of the Reformation of that city. Bucer insisted that Calvin should become the pastor of the city. Notice, everywhere he goes, somebody wants him to be the pastor. I suspect he's a pretty good preacher. The time in Strasbourg was peaceful and productive, but he longed to return to Geneva the entire time that he was there. He became a citizen of the city in August of 1540. And he married a woman by the name of Idelette de Boer, who was the widow of all things, an Anabaptist. Calvin took a bride in the same way that he wrote systematic theologies. He investigated all the possible choices in town. He made lists of which ones had which certain abilities and so forth, and he made his decisions and eventually dismissed certain suitors and others. He went through it in a very intellectual process until his friend Bucer pointed out this young lady, this widow, and so he married her. Now, little is known of their relationship. Again, unlike Luther, who wrote a lot about his wife, Calvin writes very little about his wife. He does say at one point that she was the faithful helper of my ministry. Ooh, thumbs up to that, huh? And the best companion of my life. Well, okay, that's something good to say, but Christy, that really doesn't substitute for roses, does it? No. Idelette bore him three children, all three of whom died shortly after childbirth. And she herself died only 9 years after they were married. So he was left childless and a widower just 9 years. And he never married again. So during this time, he had a good time of peace while he was in Strasbourg, away from Geneva during the 3 years he was there. But when the government in Geneva changed, he was invited to return in 1541. In fact, he was welcomed back in grand style. They gave him a great velvet robe that had a fur collar on it. They sent a carriage to get Idelette and bring her to the city, and they made a great deal of pomp and circumstance about him coming back. Now, I don't know if this is true or not. I have no corroboration of this, but I've heard it said that when Calvin returned to Geneva, the very first Sunday that he went back to his pulpit, he simply went back to the next passage of Scripture that he had been preaching before he left from that. But I have no corroboration of that rumor. Sure sounds like Calvin, but I can't prove it. Calvin, with the cooperation of the government, reorganized the church into a set of ecclesiastical ordinances. So he restructured the church itself. There were 5 pastors in the church, or doctors of theology. There were 12 lay elders, and there were a set of deacons. Excuse me. And this whole thing he put together called a consistory. The pastors, the doctors, would be responsible for the education of the entire community, specifically the theological education of the people. The elders would supervise the religious life of the neighborhoods, and the deacons would perform the social services that the church required. Sound familiar? For 12 years, the consistory that Calvin had put together and the government of the city clashed repeatedly. They struggled repeatedly. By 1553, the opposition had re-risen to power, and Calvin's political position was once again precarious in the city. And there was a threat of him being banned from the city again, which led to an incident with a man by the name of Michael Servetus. Probably one of the most well-known incidences in Calvin's time in Geneva, and one in which he is either highly praised for his approach or highly condemned for it. Time does not permit us to examine the incident with Michael Servetus tonight, but Lord willing, we'll look at it next week, because in many ways, how Calvin deals with Servetus has much to do with his theological thinking. So we'll come back to that subject. Calvin had dreamed while being in Geneva of starting an academy. We would call it a Bible school today. He wanted to start an academy in which children and young adults would come for training. And so in 1559, he finally realized his dream and opened the Genevan Academy under the direction of a man by the name of Theodore Beza. That's another name that you should tuck away in the back of your mind. Theodore Beza would eventually succeed Calvin in Geneva when Calvin would die. He would eventually become the pastor there in Geneva. Beza's background was remarkably similar to Calvin's. Growing up similarly, his conversion was similar, his training was similar, many of the things of him were very much the same. And Beza would eventually go on to not only be the pastor of the church in Geneva, but he would also be the first man to write a biography of Calvin after his death. In fact, much of what eventually became known as Calvinism stems not from the writings of Calvin himself, but from Beza, from Theodore Beza that followed after him. The school educated, of course, the youth of Geneva with Calvinistic principles. Now, when I say Calvinistic principles, I'm not talking about soteriology and predestination. I'm talking about Calvinistic principles of how does Calvin understand the totality of theology applying itself into the life of a person, his theological understanding, and the life that he lives. Okay, that in a broad brush sense. That's what I mean by Calvinistic principles in this sense. But there were also many others, non-Genevans, who came to his school. And they were also taught these Calvinistic principles, and they took them with them when they left Geneva and went back to wherever their hometown was throughout Europe. And that is how Calvinism spread throughout Europe from the days of Calvin through the days of Beza and out beyond that, because the Genevan Academy was teaching Calvinistic ideas to the kids and then sending them back out. And they were going to very many places. So Calvin in 1559 begins his Genevan Academy, but at the age of 54, May the 27, 1564, Calvin dies. But he knows he's going to die. He knows that his end has come. He doesn't die suddenly, he dies slowly. And so on his deathbed, he calls the ministers of the city. And one commentator says that he gave this rambling speech that lasted a long, long time about how these ministers were all supposed to be unified and at peace with one another and so forth. And each of those men, it is said, came and shook his hand as he lay there on his deathbed and as they left from that place. His friend, William Farrell, was living in the nearby city of Neuchâtel, came to visit him just shortly before he died, had the opportunity to visit with his old friend. before he passed on. And according to Calvin's own wishes, after he died, was buried in an unmarked grave in the city of Geneva. We don't know where Calvin's actual burial plot is today in the city, although there's the big marker in the middle of the city that says, here's where he's buried, but not really. We're not sure. He did not want anyone making pilgrimages to his gravesite. So that is the man, Calvin. Starts off as a Catholic. His father sends him to an excellent education. He is converted somewhere along the line, not with some great emotional experience, but with a deep understanding of the new doctrines of justification by faith that were spreading throughout Europe. He came to realize that that was the true teaching of Scripture. His intention was to go away and find himself a nice corner somewhere and write and read and write theology books, but he was thrust into the limelight, as he himself says, by God himself, to become the pastor of the city of Geneva, writing his magnus opus through the course of his life, defining more and more the doctrines of grace and theology that we've come to accept, eventually accomplishing even the good work of establishing a school for that in that place before the Lord took him home at the young age of 54. Beza lived to be almost 84 before he died. So that is the life of the man. The really fun part of Calvin's life is his theology, though. This stuff is all just details. But the real fun stuff is his theology. So I would encourage you to come back next week and we'll talk about that theology. And we'll see why Calvin is such a giant in the field of theology, and particularly on the Reformed side of the Protestant Reformation.